Paper being presented today is Navigating PTSD in Accident Compensation, Policy, Practice and Measuring What Matters. So if that's not what you're expecting, you're in the wrong room. We've got two presenters here today, Ash Evans and Hansi Wirasuriya. A little bit of an introduction for each of them. Ash is a principal at Taylor Fry with almost two decades of experience in the injury schemes and public health sectors. He has been the scheme actuary for Comcare since 2017 and for the South Australian CTP insurance regulator since 2021, with a particular focus on the impacts of psychological injury and its management. Ash has deep expertise in providing mental health insights to support decision makers with a robust evidence base as they develop and review scheme initiatives. And Hansi provides actuarial advice in the workers' compensation and public health sectors. She assists in the valuation of liabilities and funding forecasts for the Australian Government's Workers' Compensation Scheme and was recently involved in the costing of future workers' compensation reforms affecting the Safety, Rehabilitation and Compensation Act 1988. In other work, Hansi is involved in and undertakes quality assurance of Australia's hospital funding models, data visualisation of health costing data and predictive modelling. Please welcome our speakers.
Hiya. As mentioned, I'm Ash Evans, principal at Taylor Fry, joined with Hansi, one of our rising stars. I'll kick us off here by sort of just saying why we want to talk about this. There's a few things going on that led us to be particularly interested. It'll become to no surprise to many in the audience that there's been, in the workers' compensation space, a real growth in psych injuries and PTSD in particular, particularly in our public services. So, you know, with our work across various schemes, Australia, New Zealand, that's obviously of great interest to us as actuaries. CTP as well, secondly, has seen a real rise in PTSD, particularly associated with other claims or tagged onto other claims. And third, and probably most importantly as well, as we try and understand more via our data analytics and actuarial work, there's some frustration, I think, that psychological injuries are often talked about as a sort of a singular monolith, a homogenous group. When we think a bit more nuance, would be helpful here, not just in recognising, you know, the different individual characteristics of various diagnoses. But, you know, PTSD itself has a fairly unique or differentiated trajectory and it can be quite poor. It affects different people differently. So we thought, well, we can start adding to that conversation. And I will say that this is intended to be a bit of a conversation and a couple of actuaries standing around talking about PTSD is a perspective. We have gone and talked to a variety of schemes, clinicians in the space, and employers to get their views. And largely that's what we'll be sharing here today, but certainly would be interested in your views at the end or any questions on our sharing of others' views. The way we'd like to run it is Hansi will take the lead and lead us out. She's going to work through what we see in the space, as well as introducing PTSD as an idea, so differentiating it a little bit from other psychological injuries we might see. Safe Work Australia being kind enough to provide us some special extracts where we can delve into PTSD in particular. So a little bit she sets up the scene in that space. I'll come in closer to the end, talk about some of the emerging issues, talk about some of the comments and risks that those schemes, those employers, the clinicians saw in this particular space, and hopefully end up with a little bit of opportunity in this space for what is admittedly can be a pretty grim topic. So there is some bright lights, hopefully, at the end. So, Hansi.
Thanks, Ash, and thank you everyone for coming. In our first slide, I'll look at some headline numbers to get us a bit motivated about PTSD. And I have never used a clicker before. Okay, not that hard. So we've got some safe work data covering workers' compensation claims in Australia, which enables us to benchmark PTSD claims against the typical claims that we look at. So in the first column there, in dark blue, we have all injuries. And in light blue, we filter down to psychological injuries. And in red, we filter down further to PTSD claims. So if we look at the first row, 11.2 claims were lodged per 1,000 employees in 2023 across workers' compensation in Australia. Out of that, 1.2 claims related to psychological injuries. And out of that, 0.2 claims related to PTSD. So PTSD does not make up a material portion of claim numbers in Australia. However, if we look at the second row, over the last decade or so, overall injuries have grown at around 20%. And as we all know, psychological injuries have grown quite rapidly in the last decade. They've grown at 100%. But PTSD in particular has grown at 140%. So PTSD growth has been more rapid than the growth in psychological claims overall. And to add to that, for the average injury, a claimant is off work for 8 weeks. And if it's a psychological injury, they're off work for 4 times as long. And if it's a PTSD claim, they're off work for more than a year at 77 weeks. So we've got a rapidly growing subset of claims that are very expensive, which is why we're talking about it today. So stepping back from accident compensation for a bit, we thought we would explain PTSD as best as we can. We've broken it down into 3 parts. So firstly, what is PTSD, who experiences it, and how it's diagnosed. So PTSD is quite a unique mental health condition in that it's intrinsically linked to a specific, terrifying, and traumatic event. The sufferer might directly be exposed to it, they might have witnessed it, or they might have been exposed to it in some other way. The symptoms for PTSD might start within 3 months, but quite often it can take a very long time for symptoms to appear. And this is an important note to keep in mind when we are designing early intervention strategies, particularly around the timing of it. In cases where the intervention can only start when a PTSD diagnosis has been confirmed. And furthermore, PTSD symptoms are long-lasting or chronic. Around 40% of people have reported that they exhibit symptoms even 10 years after the initial onset of PTSD. Moving on to who experiences it, the ABS does a study on national mental health and well-being, and they report that around 11% of people will experience PTSD at least once in their lifetime. This metric does differ for men and women, so it's 14% for women and 7% for men. And this is because women are more exposed to certain types of trauma and violence in their life. So it is important to keep gender differences in mind when we are developing treatment and recovery plans. Another thing to note about the individual that experiences PTSD, although the trauma is a necessary part of developing PTSD, the trauma alone might not be sufficient. Whether or not a particular individual develops the disorder would also depend on the individual's vulnerability and their resilience and other psychological factors. So when we talk about strategies to mitigate PTSD, it should really start before any traumatic event takes place, when we are training and screening and selecting people to perform certain tasks, especially in the case of our first responders and the nature of the tasks that they have to perform. And thirdly, on PTSD diagnosis, it's not a straightforward process at all. Most workers' compensation schemes use either the DSM-4 or the DSM-5, which sets out criteria to diagnose PTSD. And in both of those definitions, there needs to be a traumatic event that leads to trauma for the individual, which in itself can have its own complexities, especially in cases where there's cumulative trauma, where there's no single event that's led to the PTSD, and Ash will touch on this a bit later. There also needs to be a number of symptoms, and they need to be enduring in that they should last for longer than a month, and they should have a significant impairment on the individual's life. So the symptoms for PTSD will overlap with the symptoms of other psychological disorders. So it makes diagnosing PTSD complex and ambiguous. And this ambiguity is particularly contentious or heightened when receiving a PTSD diagnosis makes it likelier that somebody's claim is compensable. This is there in the New Zealand context and also where presumptive PTSD has been enacted around Australia. We'll talk about both of these things in a later slide. Okay, getting back into some more statistics. The numbers on the left in dark blue we've seen before in the first slide. There are 0.2 claims lodged per 1,000 people in 2023, and they've experienced growth around 2.4-fold. To give more of an industry view on that, around 50% of PTSD claims in Australian workers' compensation is from the public administration and safety industry. They have the highest incidence rate out of all major industries in Australia, and that lands at around 1.4 claims per every 1,000 people. The more notable fact for them is that their growth has been very rapid, so their incidence is now 4 times what it used to be 8 years ago. The reason that this industry has such a high incidence is because it covers emergency service workers, among other government staff. So we thought it would be a bit more interesting to specifically focus on the emergency service workers as well. Those are the numbers in purple. We've looked at police and fire and prison officers across Australia, and the incidence is quite high. They have around 6 claims per every 1,000 people, which highlights how vulnerable this cohort is to developing PTSD. Very quickly on other industries, healthcare, education, and transport account for around another 30% of PTSD claims in Australia. So on the bottom, we also wanted to look at this rapid growth in PTSD relative to the growth in psychological injuries, which we talk about. So if we focus on the columns in red, in 2015, 19% of psychological injuries from the public administration and safety industry were for PTSD. All the way on the right, by 2023, this figure has climbed to around 30%. So for this industry, PTSD has grown faster than psychological injuries overall. The other interesting thing on this chart is that for all other industries, this proportion has remained stable at around 10%. So in my first slide, when I spoke about PTSD growing faster than psychological injuries, that disparity is really driven by the public administration and safety cohort. And we often talk about how unsustainable the growth in psychological injuries are in the public sector relative to the private sector, and a large part of that disparity is driven by this rapid growth in PTSD claims. Moving on from prevalence to cost, PTSD claims only make up around 2% of claim numbers in Australia, but their cost impact is disproportionately large. So we're looking at two metrics here. One is the average number of weeks off of work, and we've already looked at that before in the first slide. And the second is the average compensation paid per claim. So these numbers are calculated across all jurisdictions. So there are very different benefit structures in each jurisdiction. But for the purpose of comparing between injury types, the data is sufficient. For an average injury, so the numbers in dark blue, a claimant loses 8 weeks of work and is paid $16,000 for their claim. For a psychological injury, they're off work for four times as long and is paid four times as much. But for a PTSD claim in particular, they are off work for double the amount of time of an average psychological injury and is paid more than double. So this really highlights how unfavorable return to work outcomes are for people suffering psychological injuries, and particularly for PTSD. And when we talk about and read about return to work for PTSD, we've often come across this concept that the claimant should be supported to stay at work rather than leave work and coming back to work and having to be reintegrated back to a working life. In the Australian guidelines for a number of disorders, including PTSD, by Phoenix Australia, they highlight that it's rarely helpful to remove a person from their work situation altogether. And instead of giving them sick leave, they should be kept in a meaningful role within the organization. So when we talk about best practice treatment for PTSD, we often mention reducing their social isolation so that we reduce the social stigma around them reporting PTSD. We retain some normalcy in their life and we enable them to return to work faster. Okay, now that we've covered off prevalence and costs, I'll spend a bit of time talking about some of the legislative changes, particularly for PTSD in Australia. For psychological injuries, there are really two types of barriers for a claimant. There are informal barriers, which is the workplace and societal reluctance to acknowledge mental health illnesses, and there are more formal barriers, which is the compensability of a psychological injury claim or any limits to that compensation. In recent years, as we all know, these informal barriers have been gradually declining as people become more aware and more accepting of psychological health issues, and as people develop proper guidelines around treating and diagnosing these issues. For PTSD in particular, there have been a number of changes that have improved formal access as well. And a very pivotal report for these changes has been the People Behind 000 report in 2019. This was done by the Senate Education and Employment References Committee, and it investigated and recommended a unified approach for first responders with PTSD. So following that report, and in some cases preceding the report, states have now enacted presumptive PTSD for their first responders. To very quickly define presumptive liability, it automatically assumes that the injury is work-related, so employees no longer need to prove that, and it removes the burden of proof from the claimant. States have now put that in place for their first responders in Queensland, Western Australia, the Northern Territory, the public sector in Tasmania, as well as Comcare most recently. So we thought it would be good to look at the impact of these legislative changes on PTSD claim numbers. We've looked at two relatively mature presumptive PTSD programs, so that's WorkCover Queensland and WorkSafe Tasmania. And I'll explain these graphs a little bit. When we're trying to measure the impact of a legislative change that's impacted a certain cohort, we should really look at the growth in claims of that cohort relative to the growth in claims of the cohort that was not impacted. So, for example, in 2018 for WorkCover Queensland, police had 13 times the PTSD claim rate of non-first responders. Once presumptive PTSD legislation was enacted in 2021, police no longer had to prove that their injury was work-related, and non-first responders still had to use their usual pathway. So once legislation was enacted, the relativity climbed to around 20 to 30 times that of non-first responders. Similarly, in Tasmania, prior to legislation, police had a claim rate of around 25 times that of the private sector, And then in 2019, Tasmania enacted presumptive PTSD for their public sector. Once that happened, this relativity climbed to around 75 times. So you'll notice, looking at these graphs, there's no clear step jump the year that the legislation has been enacted. And this is because the upwards trend actually starts a little bit earlier than the legislation being enacted. And this is because we've spoken to both states and they've mentioned that they've developed their own internal policies and employee engagement programs prior to formalizing the presumptive laws. So that's why the trend picks up a little bit earlier. And even though these kinds of changes to formal access can have a significant impact, we should be careful when we're measuring the impact and make sure that we're talking to states and looking at the strategies and policies that they've enacted while the conversation about legislation is happening. All right, I think that's me. I'll pass on to Ash to talk about more scheme experience.
Thank you, Hansi. Okay, I'm just noting the time. I'll probably move through some things a little quick, but give time to questions. So if you see anything up here that takes your interest, becomes a good topic for a question as we go. So I'm going to try and distill as best I can what were, you know, some pretty disparate opinions in our conversations with some various schemes. And I should point out, not comprehensive, but we did manage to talk to a few schemes on this, employers and clinicians. But before I jump into those risks and some of that opportunity, I always quite like looking to New Zealand because it's a distinct scheme in this space. Australian schemes are somewhat similar to one another. So for all our differences in the PTSD space, there's quite a bit of similarity. The New Zealand experience can be pretty educational for a couple of reasons, and those reasons are listed here, and I think they lead in well to some of the risks that might be worth discussing. One of the key features of New Zealand that I think is super interesting is the exclusivity of PTSD. So psychological injuries are not well covered under ACC in New Zealand. PTSD is an exception. So while in Australia, many psychological injuries are covered through the scheme, so the distinction sometimes between PTSD and an adjustment disorder is not huge. In New Zealand, that is qualifying for the scheme or not qualifying for the scheme. So that threshold, that diagnosis of PTSD is incredibly important in New Zealand. And the reason for bringing it up here is I think there's something to keep in mind as we design schemes in Australia, particularly as we're reforming schemes and thinking about what is in and what is out. In conversations with New Zealand, there was at least a working hypothesis or an observation amongst clinicians within the scheme that this itself led to some erosion, and that is the treating practitioner was effectively incentivized to diagnose with PTSD. Now, it's a fairly extreme diagnosis. There's a lot of hurdles to get over, but where there's grey area, a PTSD diagnosis would be arrived at reasonably quickly because the alternative was entering a public health system, and the public health system for mental health in New Zealand is in something of a state of crisis. And it meant someone receiving good quality treatment versus not receiving good quality treatment. So there was some observation of erosion in that space. And in Australia, we don't have those similar sort of in or out criteria around PTSD in most instances, but we're certainly, and Hansi talked about presumptive PTSD, setting up, you know, diagnosis specific entry points in the mental health space. And that can lead to potential erosion, and it is something that we need to keep monitoring at the very least as a scheme, whether it occurs. The second item is actually probably the most interesting one, and it actually took me a little bit to get my head around this idea of a general population test, which is a diagnosis of PTSD is not actually sufficient. The diagnosis that, or the claimant also has to pass the general population test, which is sort of a question, would someone in the general population have suffered PTSD in the same instance? So you can imagine most emergency services are covered in this particular instance, but there are other events that may not be covered. Now, at least in my reading and my talking to a few schemes, the wording in DSM-4 in particular would probably... is probably equivalent to the general population test in that it does require a traumatic, a life-threatening event or threat to life and limb. DSM-5, though, which a lot of schemes operate under, is a bit more lax, a bit more generous in its definition of the traumatic event. And then I guess there's a question or a contrast there to be made between that general population test in New Zealand and the criteria in Australia under which PTSD can be assessed in Hansi's slide to get that immediate, the first step in a PTSD diagnosis to identify the life-threatening or the traumatic event. The exclusion for vicarious trauma is the other piece of the New Zealand puzzle, I think, that informs some of the emerging risks that we have here, in that vicarious trauma is excluded in that you need direct exposure to the traumatic event for it to be compensable. Again, DSM-5 in particular, repeated or extreme exposure to details of trauma are qualifying. This is going to potentially be an increasing issue for schemes, both within workforces that may be subject to that vicarious trauma, witnessing, retelling, our own case managers, for instance. And then lastly, I think it's probably worth pointing out that they also have a complex mental health panel that works through these things, because everything that comes above it sounds rather strict, but it goes through a process where the truth is, if there's grey areas, they do err on the side of the claimant. And I think the scheme generally recognises that falling outside of the ACC system in the mental health space is a pretty arduous affair. So with that background that I thought worth pointing out in advance while I move along the slides, I would like to talk about some of the emerging risks in the space as discussed with our stakeholders, vulnerability, cumulative trauma, and complex PTSD. And I think it did come up this morning as well, the sort of increased vulnerability in the population. It's a real risk. It may be very well in part what we're seeing in recent times, although there's a few things at play there in terms of this sharp increase in PTSD. But there's a genuine increased susceptibility in the population, and I think a genuine question, particularly when it comes to in terms of sustainability of the schemes, how our rules around significant contribution play into that, significant contribution of the workforce in most instances. To contrast that with the New Zealand general population test, most Australian schemes require the workplace to have a significant contribution to the industry, but by and large, they take the person as they are. That person as they are may have historical trauma. It can be quite difficult to distinguish, to pinpoint exactly what is the root cause of trauma, and in fact, cumulative trauma, as we'll discuss, is a real thing. The hurdle for establishing a significant contribution in the workplace has the potential to fall. The other thing going on, of course, is not just historical trauma, but as mentioned there, pre-existing neurological or psychological vulnerabilities, and something when we were working with clinicians or talking to clinicians in this space that came up loud and clear and is particularly interesting to us given the growth that we've seen in autism spectrum disorder diagnoses for children who will ultimately enter the workforce at some stage, is what does significant contribution of the workplace mean to someone neuroatypical? Where their reaction to conflict in the workplace may look very different or maybe far more extreme than that general population test we talked about earlier. That was identified as a key risk going forward and something I think we really need to think about quite carefully in both how people are treated in the workplace, what sort of safe workplace initiatives we could put in place, but also what is compensable in schemes. Cumulative trauma, very conscious of time now. This bit's super important, so I'm going to dwell for a second here. Most emergency services claims aren't well, traumatic event, PTSD. That's actually not how they tend to occur. The majority of them are due to sensitization, so repeated exposure to trauma and getting worse and worse. So initially distress, interpersonal conflict in the workplace, often self-medicating at some stage during that distress. Alcohol abuse is a real common comorbidity in the population. Often, particularly in emergency services and law enforcement, discipline reaction is part of the process, and historically potentially have been largely discharged, certainly from law enforcement, without any claim. And it may be that this huge ramp up in PTSD claims we're seeing, particularly in our emergency services, is in large part due to better recognition in the workforce that all these people were being lost. They were actually being booted out of the force or moved on in some way. And now it's better recognised this pattern of sensitisation to traumatic events causing genuine psychological harm, causing PTSD. So in some sense, this increase in claims is a good news story, but it's also a great risk for the scheme. And in talking to, I won't dob them in, but the employees in particular, there's also a suspicion that now it's well established that there's this distress, interpersonal conflict, discipline reaction pattern. The concern amongst employers is that there's an adverse selection effect, which might mean that once someone is undergoing a disciplinary action, that a claim for PTSD is actually a reasonable out. Now, that sounds all rather cold, and establishing a PTSD diagnosis is quite difficult, but at the same time, those involved in emergency services will be able to very quickly jump the traumatic event hurdle, and many psychological disorders, as Hansi discussed earlier, do share symptoms with PTSD. So exactly how to manage that risk, I'm not sure, but it's certainly something on employers' mind in this space as we start allowing people to recognise that PTSD from that increased trauma, but also making sure it's not effectively abused as a mechanism during the disciplinary process. And lastly, and I'll be super quick on it, complex PTSD is a diagnosis under ICD-11. It doesn't really get acknowledged in schemes at all, but it's probably there. And rather than a risk, I think it's probably just worth acknowledging that there is a separate diagnosis for complex PTSD. It comes with additional symptoms, dysregulation and entrenched avoidance, which will mean return to work is very hard for this particular group of people. So as schemes, I think it probably would benefit from acknowledging it, because there's certainly the treatment differs, and it's very likely that our expectations for those particular victims would differ as well. So I am cautious not to only talk about the negative things or how poorly it's going, because there is a lot of good stuff going on in this space. Mentally safe workplaces is something that the National Mental Health Commission talk about. There's plenty of good work out there. There's that 2024 paper. I know ComCare, amongst others, has released some really good work on it. When we're talking about PTSD, we're really talking about mentally safer workplaces. We do expect emergency service workers to expose themselves to trauma as a matter of course, and that's why these safeguards are so important. A supportive trauma enforced workplace we're getting so much better at. We're getting a lot better at screening and psychometric testing on the way into roles within these organisations, debriefs, situations where effectively that increase that we're seeing in claims is in part due to the various programs, as Hansi said, that have been introduced both before and after the presumptive PTSD that recognise the strain that many emergency service workers are under. There's still a lot of stigma there, and maybe not even stigma. There's a lot of detriment to making a claim in the PTSD. It's not innocuous. you will see in law enforcement additional pays or stipends or allowances given in salaries for a use of force qualification. Use of force qualifications will get taken away if you make a PTSD claim, so it has a financial detriment. Various postings are only available to those with clear screens, for instance. So there is financial and sort of career implications for making these claims as well. These aren't going to go away in a hurry, but it's probably worth recognising that there is some reticence still to claim in that space. And so we can get to questions just on those last two, early intervention and return to work. If you were to take one thing out of the one thing I've taken in talking to the various people around the schemes and employers, and I hope you take away, is that particularly with that sensitisation issue being the majority of emergency services claims, when a PTSD claim is made, in many instances it's too late. Or at very least your case managers have one arm tied behind their back. As Hansi mentioned, the best practice advice is that an individual shouldn't leave the workplace at all. They should stay in meaningful work. That's very difficult, easy to say, very hard to achieve when the meaningful work is the trauma-inducing work. But it is worth, if we were to focus on one particular area, and you can see there an early intervention, we're talking immediately proactive outreach after a traumatic event during, you know, that period of sensitisation, psychological first aid, early clinical engagement. If there's one thing as schemes that I think we need to do better and focus on, and really the employers are in a sense calling out for, is that the schemes look a bit further back into pre-claim and be providing the right programs or making sure there are the right programs in place and potentially even providing the financial incentives to run programs well for the employers themselves to do better in this space, to do that screening, to do that psychological testing, to make their workforce a bit more resilient. So the ultimate event that causes that PTSD claim happens less frequently. So that's the call to arms, and it's quite late, so I'll hand to Andrew for questions. Thank you.
There isn't very much time left for questions. I can use the line that I'm sure that if you do have questions, Ash and Hansi would be more than pleased to engage you in conversation outside of the room. We do have the microphone. There's no questions at the moment come through on the online route. I haven't got a roving microphone here, but there is the one in the middle as well. Does anybody have any questions that they'd like to ask any of our speakers?
Thanks very much, guys. I'm Jeanette from Suncorp, CTP. I was just thinking about, you know, suggestions about increased screening for maybe propensity to develop PTSD. And I noticed that women, I didn't know previously, women develop PTSD or are diagnosed with it at a much higher rate than men. Whether there's some, you know, whether that should be considered, whether something would be lost, whether there's any level of discrimination, all these challenging things, if there's any thoughts around that.
Did you want to show that? No. Okay. Yeah, and I think it's important that we distinguish between the general statistics as opposed to accident compensation, where it would look quite differently, largely due to the makeup of the emergency services, I suspect, as well. Domestic violence and things like that have a large contribution to the PTSD in the female population and the male. And to be honest, in the context of this talk, the most important thing to take out of it is Phoenix, who's really the authority locally on it, suggests that the treatment pathways also look quite different between men and women with PTSD, and that's probably a really important consideration for schemes to consider. But the distinction in the rate, and it is a big distinction, is while there's some arguments or weak evidence around other causes for it as well, is dominated by pure exposure to traumatic events being far higher. Women are exposed to traumatic events than men in the population. Yeah.
Are there any other questions? I'm presuming none have come through on the speaker. If there are no other questions, then please join me in thanking our two speakers.